I am Lina Mirmond. I have exceptional privilege to introduce my guest, Jerry Wenstrom, and his most incredibly uniquely inspiring book, which has a title, The Inspired Heart. I have somewhat difficulties to call him just an author, because his talent, his emotional refinement goes way beyond just to be an author. I think he's an artist in every form and every fact of his own expression. And I'm sure we will be totally captivated by his personality, by his book, and his observation of life inside out. I like to invite and welcome my very special guest, Jerry Wenstrom, who allowed me to call him by his first name. So, Jerry, welcome.
Thank you very much, Lina, and thank you for the wonderful introduction. I hope I can live up to your wonderful praise, so thank you.
Well, you lived up not only on a local scale praise, you won many hearts and minds who had this expedition of their own life through your book. I like to comment on the introduction. I would not say that I'm a greatest connoisseur of reading the most outstandingly interesting books. However, I need to acknowledge that your introduction is such a focal point of your book. It has so much already most important ideas, the purpose of the book, your own version of your own searching who you are, that I frankly pleasantly got stuck in the introduction. And if you, not to say that I didn't move forward beyond that, I certainly did, because you energized my emotional curiosity to follow through other chapters of your book. But the introduction certainly was incredibly intriguing in the beginning, and then it was very profound. Well, your first sentence, which indicates immediately that you decided to take a challenge and to take this very scrupulous emotional journey in your life. And that sentence says that in 1979, I destroyed all the art I had created, gave everything I owned away, and began a new life. I will leave arena for you and to rediscover with all of us what was your predecision to this, what moved you to such extreme and yet most natural way of rediscovering and re-enjoying your life.
Yes, well, I don't think anything necessarily happens that we're not at some level prepared for. And I felt many whispers along the way sort of leading up to that leap. I think, you know, just generally speaking, in the context of the studio, there's an element of risk where you know, in the creative process, you take certain risks. And in doing that, there's always the potential to destroy your own status quo or what you've done up until that point. But in taking the risk is how something inspired comes through. So after being very driven as a painter, and I had an enormous body of work, I got to the place where I felt really comfortable being who I was as an artist in the studio. And it's almost the moment I said, what a good boy am I can do this, the gods upped the ante, and I felt like I had to do it with my whole life. So, but there were many little whispers that pointed in that direction, which, you know, I go into in more detail in my book. But I felt when that calling came, I fasted for a month, and it just became very clear that I could keep doing what I was doing, but it felt like a fear-based choice to keep doing that. Or I could give myself to that alluring possibility that promised nothing, guaranteed nothing, but I sensed would transform my life. So on the strength of that abstract sense of something larger, or staying in the safety of the fear-based reality I had become comfortable with, I made the leap, and I decided to just trust the universe with my life, which is what I ended up doing for the next 15 years. And at some level, I'm still doing, but that was the real beginning of that process, the big bang, you might say.
I like to go into some episodes of your book. Of course, naturally, in one program, we cannot even touch the main, most critically important phases of your transformation and actually human vision. But I will try to ask your kind elaboration in a few experiences, which being somewhat pivotal points of your journey. One which I remember is the somewhat not very willingly, but by circumstances, happened the attendance of your own documentary, where, in fact, your art and your life, which was preceding your modulation from that, was very well expressed. And frankly, when I was reading about this, I felt very good that at least documentary saved your art. So in case if someone would have this burning curiosity, cautiously I would say yourself as well, at least can have a documentary and to see what it was, where I am now, and where I will be. So I remember these episodes where you joined for Jewish Sabbath, I believe, your very good friend. And she actually remembered about this special night at the church, if I'm remembering correctly the location. And then you've been a little bit forced by the circumstances to go and to attend this documentary. Could you put in words again what was the complexity in between reality that this is you are, with your already well-established fame, recognition, crowd of people around you and your art, and yet your internal, totally opposite state of mind and emotions?
Yes, well, I think that, you know, we all come into the world, especially as in our teens and early 20s, thinking that we can do what's never been done. I mean, we think with our will, intelligence, and good intentions that that's enough, you know, to really tap into something large and universal. And, you know, I often use the quote that by Yogananda, that where he says, to set out on any holy purpose and to die along the way is to succeed. I think inevitably when we give our heart and soul to that which we love to do or what we're doing with our life, inevitably we come up against the limits of those three factors, will, intelligence, and good intentions. I mean, at some level I thought I was, you know, tapping into the divine, and in some way was, and that inspiration was enough. And yet there was this place where all of a sudden it all felt empty. And I looked at the art scene, and Soho was flying high in New York at that time, and the whole world was just on board with this bandwagon of the art scene. And yet I felt the lie at the core of it. And in some way it was the same lie that I was feeling within myself, that I'm still running the show, and I knew that I had to give myself to something larger than my own knowing. And so, you know, the sheer terror of giving myself to that mystery, and yet the alluring inspiration was just, you know, it was nothing to back away from. I just sensed it with everything in my being. And it turned out to be the most important thing I've ever done with my life. I mean, my whole life, in a whole new way that I never would have imagined, was launched at that point, in a way. And even as an artist, I became, you know, more known as an artist for destroying my art than for creating it. And I never would have imagined. I think that's all part of the paradox. You know, you put what you love on the altar, and in some magical, mysterious way, it's sanctified and comes back to you. That is the meaning of sacrifice, to make sacred. And all of this wasn't some great plan on my part. It was just following those minuscule inspirations and inclinations and feelings about something larger. So, I mean, in a way, it was a very positive allurement. It, you know, I mean, people often say, well, were you, you know, did you burn out, or were you angry at the art scene? And none of that was true. I mean, it was absolutely an inspired leap. After I made the leap, I mean, part of me says, oh, God, now what do I do? Who am I now with no identity, with no, you know, nothing? So it had all of those elements. And I think the element of paradox, where you have those dueling elements, is all very natural in the creative process. I think any artist, and I'm sure there are many listening who know the territory themselves, know the power of entry into that unknowing.
Absolutely. You brought so many extra thoughts, but I will interrupt myself, and I just wanted to express my total endless admiration for your language. Being in an artistic field, I would say that you paint as an artist naturally, but you're also painting when you're describing the process, your emotions and events. Your, needless to say, vocabulary, but your parallels and your profound tactfulness and yet totally uncompromising approach to most sacred points of human nature is just astonishing. So I just wanted to make sure that there is a tremendous power of an abstract emotional impact when one is reading your book, and yet it's very real, because, of course, everything can be turned into simplification and be very primitive, like you said just now, that it wasn't just the simplicity of anger or dissatisfaction with particular painting which you wanted to repaint again. That was very profound realization, and complexity of it certainly goes way beyond just a description. It's your emotional mission, if I would say.
Well, thank you, Lena. I appreciate. I mean, I think at some level you wouldn't have that understanding if you didn't know the territory yourself. You know, I think you are every bit as articulate, and you know, and it's amazing, your use of the English language is pretty impressive as well. So I think, you know, there's always a, for something to be a reality, I mean, we all, you know, I think certainly when we're younger, we all create something of a persona, you know, an idea of ourselves that we put out to the world. And more, most often, that comes crashing down at some point. And I think, you know, the kind of resonance with a story or with a mythos, you know, a personal or collective mythos that we can relate to, I think the what makes it real isn't the fact that somebody's out there convincing us of the reality of it. It's more like it resonates in our bones and we know the reality of it. And I think that's the only reality there is. And I think part of that surrender that we're talking about, and it goes for all of us, if it doesn't tap into to what is, not what we want to be, but what is, it has no reality. And it's exactly that reality that has carried my life all these years. I think that's the nature of true being and true reality, is that it will carry your life. And there are places where your silence becomes, and your joy becomes, the best defense of reality, because you don't have to do anything about it except be fully who you are. And that's such a complete privilege. You know, most of us are trying to be something other than what we most naturally are. And I think the gift of our true identity is self-sustaining.
It certainly is, but unfortunately, again, in the reality, not everyone can complete this journey. And if I may come back to your idea of a paradox, dialectic of philosophy comes in mind very often, because there are contradictions. In a tree, old leaf dies in order to make a space for the new leaf, which will be a continuation of the old in its anatomy, in its shape, expression, but still in its physical body, it will be a new leaf. So I believe that what you express in this paradox is actually the most natural thing. And if I respectably will disagree with what you said about destroying your art, you really, by destroying your art, you created instantly the new one. It's just different form, different shape, and you produce this incredible book. And I don't know if you're back to painting or not, but by destroying this enormous creation of yours, you instantly created a new creation. You created a new vision of yourself. Tremendous bravery, tremendous intuition you had, and certainly incredible vision. Very rare for the artists, who are usually captivated by their emotions, lack of any kind of a satisfaction, any kind of vision, and often end up in destruction.
Well, yes. I mean, in some way, when after destroying the work, it was mostly about just, you know, I think giving myself, and this is kind of the template for the, you know, the very nature of the journey, where a certain amount of house cleaning comes in, where, you know, to give yourself so completely to the mystery. And it, you know, I happen to be a willing participant. I see, and I'm working with many people who do it by way of circumstances. You know, they go through a painful divorce, or their lives come undone in some way. And that's the beginning of that journey, where they too are thrown into the unknown. I don't think it matters a whole lot whether you jump in like I did or you don't. I mean, I suppose the subtle difference is, might be what Joseph Campbell calls the hero's journey. To be a willing participant is probably the best seat in the house, at least, you know, not that the journey is any easier or that you know any more, but in that you've already said yes, and there's a lot that, you know, that counts for a lot in the willingness to stay focused. Although, you know, we all end up on our knees no matter what in that journey. But in terms of the paradox, it's very much written into, you know, Carl Jung worked extensively with alchemy later in his life, and he said that if he knew what he knew then about alchemy, he would have given his life to it earlier, because he found such incredible meaning and in terms of a Western tradition. And, you know, one of the things in alchemy is it describes and it embodies that paradox very beautifully, in that, you know, and the paradox being male, female, up, down, I mean, black, white, all of the opposites. And there's a way in the alchemical process you arrive at the place where you have to fully inhabit the emptiness of those two opposites, where they both have equal power. And there's simply a holding of the emptiness itself that allows for new creation. So, you know, the nature of paradox is, you know, just part of and an important part of transformation. There's no way to get there from here by way of what we have available. And it's in that unknowing that that something new is born. You know, in terms of doing art again, you know, it sounds like you haven't seen the new art. I have these large interactive sculptures I'm doing now. They can be seen on our website of handsofalchemy.com. But, you know, that took many, many years to get back into form, because what I jumped into was so completely formless, and I had to learn the nature of formlessness for many years before I began taking on form again. You know, ultimately getting married in my late 40s and doing art again, and it was like I had to leave the world so completely, and then in some way, when you finally become comfortable with that, once again, the gods call you back into the world. And I think that, too, is part of the nature of the journey, is that you need to go into the desert, find who you are, find your true identity in relation to that mystery, and then bring it back to the world. It's just as natural as the tide.
I have to confess to something about your website. Because of your extraordinarily shocking revolution of your life, I did not connect exactly that your arts, which you're talking about, indeed relating to your present life, that it is back. The other thing I wanted to notice that we had difficulties to find your last name and your website. It's a first name of your wife, Marilyn, and your first name. But there is absolutely mystery about your last name. Maybe it's hidden in some of your artwork, in some kind of calligraphy, but there is no way to find your last name.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it's, I know it's in there a lot. You know, there are many interviews, there are written interviews, there are articles, there's the book with the title and my name, and you know, Parabola magazine made the original film that's on there. So I mean, I know it's there, but it's a good point. Maybe we should tell the person who gifted us to put our last name.
People already more than satisfied to have you as a first name, and it's your somewhat a little subtle, charming point, but I just wanted to let you know. I'd like to come back to the book. It was dedicated to your mother, who I understand passed away very recently.
Yes.
I lost my mother a very few years ago, and that's something one never can realize. I believe losing the mother is a totally incomprehensible grief compared to other grief you might experience losing some other members or friends of your family. How did it change your perception of life?
My mother's death, you're asking? Well, you know, you're probably not going to like my answer, but it is the reality for me. I feel in many ways part of the work I mentioned earlier that came up after letting everything go was dealing with the family shadow. You know, my wife's Native American teachers say the most important work we can be doing at this time is healing the bloodline. And I feel like what happened at that time after destroying my work had and there are stories in the book, I'm not sure you got to those, that get into that. It was such a healing in terms of dealing with the unconscious baggage, you might say, of family. And I think, you know, like most parents, I think my parents did their very best within their own limitations, but they did have their limitations. And I feel like the work I did at that time somehow freed me of any really deep emotional attachment to my parents and to my mother, to my father. And, you know, I was happy to know they were there in their little lives doing what they were doing, but in some way I was so taken out of it in that transformational process that it wasn't that big an impact when my parents died. You know, there was the initial sadness that, you know, they're not there doing that anymore, doing their garden, doing their canning, doing their lives. And, you know, and that I still feel the sadness of thinking that. But it really didn't run much deeper than that, you know. I mean, they had good lives. They lived their lives the best they could. And yet, you know, also I feel like I got so much more from, you might say, the divine father, the divine mother, that there's no comparison. And I honor my parents and I love my parents. And yet, at some level, like most of our parents, they failed miserably. You know, what I inherited was all the stuff they inherited. And they didn't necessarily do their work. And if somebody didn't do it, I would just be passing it right on to the next generation. And I feel the real gift did not come from them. I mean, my life did, and I honor it and all of that. But there is something greater than love for family, love for parents, and it's love for God.
I thank you for a very, very sincere answer. And that opened a little bit of my own reflections on my own parents, and you almost inspired me to respond in a sense of my own regrets that there is a certain thing, especially from my father's side, I wanted to share with him and I could not. So I would go a little deeper, maybe even stronger than you described, because forming my own individuality and my own ideals, I felt that there's certain restrictions because of my own father's baggage, which limited me from having this very free-flowing exchange and dialogue. So I'm very well aware what you're talking about. And at the same time, I just wanted to... I was curious how much of an impact your mother, since you were dedicating your book to her, had on your life. Also, there is no secret you dedicated your book to your wife, and you've been married in a very mature age. Is your wife a twin of your emotional sphere? I'm sure she didn't have a choice but to share your environment.
Yes, she does.
Is she an artist herself?
Oh, yes, she's a singer. She does a lot of things. I mean, she is a pioneer. You know, I think there's a movement in this country that is stirring quite strongly now, which has to do with reclaiming, as they did home births in the 60s, 70s, there's a reclaiming of home and family funerals, and she's doing that. You know, we've done so much work with the metaphoric death process, which is what we've been talking about for the most part, and now it has extended into literally being present with families and creating the whole ceremony, everything from having the family involved if they want to, washing the body and doing home and family funerals, the whole process. So she's excited about doing that kind of work right now. But she sings. I mean, we were on the road, we toured with Parabola with their film festival when our film came out. And she was right there with me, and she opened all of our events with songs and rituals, and so she's very much a part of my life, and her art form certainly is. It's in the film. It's in most of what I do.
We are going to hear, just in a few moments, a piece of music, since you mentioned your wife's musical gift. And I believe it will be a lovely bridge to our second part of the conversation. I like to leave this little moment of music with one saying which impressed me deeply in your book. It's saying, He who fears to be foolish will never learn to be wise. I think it expresses a lot in your own journey and in your own process. You certainly put fears in some kind of secluded place, and you honor wisdom. I like to have a little bit piece of music reflect on this thought.
Okay.
Music by Julian Lampert. He called it meditation. I'm back to my conversation with most eloquent and deeply talented and spiritual person, who is the author, painter, sculptor, and most important, thinker. Jerry Weintraub, with his thoughts and his wonderful book, which we are browsing through from some thoughts, more the thoughts, ideas than from chapter to chapter. I like to ask you about your first story. It's called Hilda's Gift. Would you agree that that was somewhat very important, one of the pivotal points of your self-realization?
Well, as I said earlier in the beginning of the interview, I mentioned there were many whispers along the way. That was certainly one of them. You know, I tried to choose those little moments where things became clearer and lead into the book with that. So, you know, it was certainly important, but there were many, you know, and there are several stories early on in the book that lead into how it is I ended up destroying my work. And I feel like, you know, none of us, we need to find reassurance from the universe. And you know, and sometimes we spend a whole lot of our energies and time avoiding the messages we're getting. And I feel like the story with Hilda was one of those whispers. It was one of those messages that was strong and beautiful, and it just made me take one step closer to just giving myself, you know, 100% to the path. But it was certainly important, but it wasn't the only one.
Okay, well, the only reason I mentioned this because it's a first story, and again, your description, almost theatrical way of introduction and the whole description of the scene and all different aspects of this woman's gift as a speaker, as a dancer, communicator. I felt it is so incredibly telling, and mostly I think this woman has a gift to speak to the crowd and at the same time to speak to the individual as well. You establish some eye-to-eye contact, and she even gave you a little piece of her own chewing candy, if I understood it correctly.
Yes. Yes, I mean, her name is Hilda Charlton, and she's, you know, she's well known. She died many years ago, but there are books about her. She was a substantial spiritual teacher on the scene back then and continues to be. I mean, she was that was the one and only time I had ever visited her. But it was certainly a powerful event, and she was a very powerful woman, no question about it.
I like to read one of your breathtaking phrases. And I would say, even if you don't understand exactly what it means, the sound of it, so incredible. But I think I did get the meaning. I, however, feel that it will be very valuable if you will elaborate and describe from your own standpoint of view the meaning of this thought. For some reason, one of many eloquent sentences, this struck me as one of them. Seasoning sanctifies and builds on the integrity of a new reality with organic resonance in the hearts of individuals. I'd like for you to open up more on this thought.
Well, it's like I said earlier, when I first destroyed my work and gave everything I owned away, there, you know, all that is before you is this incredible void. There's no more identity. When someone asks, who are you, there's nothing to say. You know, you're no longer doctor, lawyer, Indian chief. You know, who are you? And what comes out of that emptiness? I think the sense that seasoning sanctifies, it's seasoning being time, experience, deep listening, meditation, you know, experience that comes through that might scare the hell out of us. Or, you know, I think in that you come to trust, and again, it gets also back to those messages along the way. You get back and you start to learn to trust those minuscule promptings, those, you know, those quiet voices from reality that are just leading the way and that are also coming through with the mystery and the magic and the miracle that you need to survive. Because I gave all my money away, so how do you eat? I never asked anyone for anything. I simply trusted. And there was something about that level of trust that brought everything into play. And so the aspect of seasoning comes into play by way of time and consistency, and you know, and that's not to say I didn't want to run for cover on occasional, because it was terrifying at some level to do what I did with my life, and yet the miracle that consistently came through, not when I wanted it, but when I needed it, that's what builds integrity. And I think when that is established, it gets back also to what we were saying about there's no longer any need to defend the reality. You know, the integrity comes in that just your very being, the best of who you are by, and that which you most are. You know, that's what we are here on the planet to be and do and express. You know, that is integrity. It's not our idea of ourselves, because we all create ideas of ourselves, you know, that persona that may or may not survive. But to truly inhabit the territory of our own true, simple, innocent being, there is no greater integrity. I love what Annie Dillard says, that there's nothing more awesome than a mountain because it's so conspicuous. And you think of how, you know, how conspicuous are we for the most part? I mean, most of us are so putting so much time and energy into finessing, you know, our reality to look a certain way that I think we don't know who we are. I mean, what if we were as simple as a mountain, just being, you know, and being the essential depth of what we are meant to be? There's no greater luxury than to be exactly who we are and to have the world respond to that. And that's where the resonance comes in. I think, you know, I think no matter what's going on the surface, no matter how crazy you look, and it gets back to that, he who fears to be foolish will never learn to be wise. I think wisdom comes through when we can fully inhabit that state of being that simply is, and it does resonate with others, and you don't need to defend it, and they know, they trust who you are just by you being most who you are. And that goes for all of us. I mean, I don't think I have anything more or less than anyone else in it, and it's very hard-earned territory to get that simple, but I think that's what we're here to become.
Well, in our society, which unfortunately, at least I hope I'm optimistic, for a relatively short period of time, will be so machinery-oriented, so commercial, so material, and so artificially decorated with the finesse which you mentioned, certainly is craving more than ever as a survival journey to regain this sense of humanity, to honor our instinct, and I would say perfume of our instinct, to listen to ourselves. We have such a great difficulties to find the moment for oneness, to find the moment to have this internal dialogue with ourselves. And yet it is totally unavoidable. It is critically important for human survival. And what you're describing has a little deceptive simplicity, because your journey was so dramatic, with so much pathetic moment. I would make a parallel with the giant symphony orchestra, where if great conductor sees, hears orchestra as a whole, but also aware with his ear and soul of the sound of each musician. I believe that you are that conductor who was able to orchestrate by instinct and then by nature of your intellectual craving this journey. And that's why you be able to regain who you are and come back to all these elements in your art or music or your writing with the way you feel, the only way you can be true to yourself.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your kind words. And I feel at some level, you know, I was as much orchestrated as anyone else, except I feel like we can be orchestrated by that one that orchestrates the orchestrator. You know, I think there is a larger voice, a larger, you know, control, knowing, a larger, you know, mythos that gladly leads the way if we're paying attention. So, and again, you know, I came kicking and screaming just like everybody else at times. And I think, you know, but it never, I think we shouldn't allow that to stop us. You know, we're going to come up against our fears, our limitations, our ideas of what's real and what's not real. You know, this society screams who we should be, and yet, you know, mostly it's fear-based. I think to allow ourselves to be orchestrated by, you know, mystery larger than our own limited knowing, it takes courage for all of us, and it's completely available to all of us. And I do believe my life has unfolded in a way that has been an incredible gift, and I certainly don't deny that, but I sure don't feel like the orchestrator.
Well, you certainly are, at least for others. I'm sure there is a beautiful addiction in your book, because you describe the most natural part of our own desires with a genuine, incredibly eloquent finesse of your words and your certainly phrases. Some of them I could not resist to repeat on the air. I like to ask you about some maybe simplistically put, but your vision of certain earthy qualities like discipline, like completing the circle, which you indeed mentioned in a concept you were talking about in your book. What is the process at this time of your creation? Do you have difficulties, for example, to complete your sculpture, or you're looking for endless perfection? What is Jerry's inside process for creating the artwork?
Well, I mean, I think the artwork is pretty indistinguishable from my life. I mean, it really, you know, Picasso said it took his whole life to learn to paint like a child. So, you know, your idea of simplistic is pretty accurate, except what it takes to really simplify, you know, our way of being present with the universe requires enormous complexity, and we can complicate it much, much, much more than it needs to be complicated. But the simplicity of where I have arrived in my own journey is there is no discipline, there is no practice, there is no God, you know, particular God, you might say. There is only listening and being present with the moment. And I know that's incredibly simplistic, but that really is what it all boils down to. Because you can't know one moment to the next what is going to be required of us. I mean, there is always this inevitable, you know, unknowing that we have to live with. And I think out of that, what becomes our nature is to be comfortable with that. And again, it also gets back to the paradox, to be able to hold the, you know, the fear of falling off the edge, or the, you know, the excessive hope of getting out of a difficult situation, and simply being where we are. That's where things unfold. And in terms of my art, it's really an extension of that process. And what I find so curious about my art, now I'm doing these large interactive sculptures. They're carved cedar, and they're all very human-like. They're boxes, and yet there are beings inside. There are secret compartments. There are mechanical devices. Some of them, one of them even has a steam engine. You light a fire in the belly, and they do things. But they're all very coffin-like. If you look at the work, my studio is full of them. They're from 6 to about 10 feet high, and there are many of them here now. And if you look at them, the initial impact, you might say, is that they're kind of spooky. I had a person here visiting from St. Louis recently, and he walks in my studio, and he's kind of a nervous little guy anyway, and he says in a very nervous way, you know, if someone weren't in a very good space, they'd be kind of afraid of this place. And so I feel like it became an expression of my journey, in that which always frightened me is what I gave attention to. I mean, the easy parts, to be with the beautiful, lovable people, to be with the easy circumstances, to be with the abundance when it was available, I mean, that's easy. Anyone can do that. I felt like my journey has been very much about facing my fears. And what I see in retrospect is that this art that I'm doing now, it's very death-like. You get the hit of this might be death. And yet, when you can go and you push the buttons or you turn the knobs or you open the doors, what they are is whimsical, and some of them deliver gifts, and some of them make sounds or play music or do things that I think are joyful. And that is such a complete expression of what my life has been. Whenever I sensed there was a boogeyman behind me, I would turn around and face it, and what I found is that there was a gift there. And that is the basic template of my journey. Walk into your fear and find God.
Well, we are talking about creation and fear. I personally feel that creativity is the most successful weapon against the fear. I hate to use word weapon, but I'm hoping to justify this strong word, because fear can take such a powerful, unlimited space in our soul. And so many people with most tremendous gifts are not known to themselves first and to the world second. Mostly I am deeply taken by the fact that you probably come to the closest moves in your life, to the closest status of total fearless moments, because you don't aim for something which your ego craving. You're aiming only for something which your inner voice telling you and make your life content or maybe in conflict. But it's not the ego which is ruling your life. It's your vision, it's your art, and you gain your freedom where there's no place for fear, I feel.
Well, yes, and if we all would ask ourselves what is the alternative to that, we would all be doing that, wouldn't we? Because, you know, I think we can do what's never been done. We think we can make something real that's not real, you know. And the fact is, the alternative is useless suffering. To do anything other than that is to create extra useless suffering in our lives. So it's just the nature of reality. And I think creativity really is a kind of defense against fear, because creativity, I mean, the very nature of it is this sort of, you know, it's almost like a black hole in space. It has incredible potential. It can consume a star, it can create a star, and yet it's a stirring ball of emptiness. And I think, you know, in order to create, we have to enter into that emptiness, and it's very much alive. It's just a formless emptiness that has the potential for anything. And the only way to create is not to create what our egos think we should be creating. It's more like to create what is. Like if God wanted to smile on the world one day, what would that smile look like? And how can we be a willing participant in expressing that smile? You know, it might be a dance. It might be a creation. And I think any artist worth their salt is going to be as awed by what's coming through them as they are coming from that place as anyone experiencing the art form. And that's the nature of it. So an artist themselves can't even claim responsibility for the creation. You can only be thankful. It's a reverent involvement. It's not an egotistical involvement. I mean, there's a thankfulness. When I pull off an art piece that I feel awed by, I am just thankful. I feel like at some level I just got away with murder, because I'm a bozo that don't know what in the hell I'm doing, and yet this incredible beauty can come out of nowhere, and it just leaves me in a state of reverence.
Absolutely. Such a beautiful thought. Incredible thought, which indeed, I believe, engraved the thoughts that regardless whether you're deeply religious or you're not, you're part of this universal, in a very authentic way, process. So your expression becomes part of universal expression, and yet universe certainly does appreciate and constantly communicates with what you have to offer. So it's almost like a spiritual round trip which you manifest in your life. And that comes in mind another beautiful say in your book, which says, slave for the world or slave for God. I think you choose the second one.
Yes, that's actually a saying by Yogananda. He said, a slave you must be. You're either a slave to the world or you're a slave to God. And so, yes, I think that that is true. You know, we're either operating out of the dictates of fear and survival, or we're in dialogue with that larger mystery, and we're excited and we're awed by what might come out of that. But in some way, I don't think, you know, in terms of an ego creating, I think mostly what we create with our ego is a mess that ultimately turns to dust. What comes out of that larger conversation with the universe, you might say, it's something that lasts. I mean, it's what we call inspired. It's what makes great art or great conversation or great love. It makes everything that's most beautiful in the planet. And I think, you know, it's about that level of communication with the divine, you might say, which we all have access to. You know, it's a priority. What are we doing with our time and energy? How much energy and time are we putting into trying to make ourselves safe when we're going to die anyway? And how much time and energy are we putting into participating in this incredibly awesome dance of the universe and expressing it in the world in whatever form? It can be sitting on a mountaintop saying nothing, doing nothing. I mean, it doesn't have to look like form at all. And I know for my own journey, you know, one of the most difficult things I ever had to do was nothing. I mean, I could do anything coming out of a very driven life in the studio, doing nothing and still expressing that divine smile, you might say, was one of the most difficult things. And it's also very feminine, generally speaking. I think, generally speaking, women are much more comfortable, or men who embody the feminine more are much more comfortable in the vastness of that unknowing than men are. I mean, generally speaking, the masculine needs to define reality, needs to create it and look at it and identify with it. I mean, to be comfortable in that great void and to be able to express beauty by way of our very being is almost, you know, impossible for masculine mind.
Well, a masculine mind from a Stone Age is a provider. I hate to bring those material words in our conversation, but you're a little bit by making this comment, which brings another thought in your book, which has to do with a reason. A reason has an important place in our lives, but its range is limited. So I believe that because each of us has ability to create certain reasoning and either justification or thriving for a new horizon, but the reason, something which you've been very, very clear, you refuse to be another of those stereotypic behavior, and you created your own, or I should say recreated, your own very profound reason for being, for your life, and you're deceptive sometimes saying that you're doing nothing. I think not for one bit, just like your heart, your emotion is not occupied with something.
Yes, I agree. That's true for all of us. And I think it's one of the most difficult things to actually see in our lives is, you know, the power of presence. I mean, what is that presence that we feel in all things beautiful? And how do we allow it to come into our lives? I mean, and be and identify with as part of our totality. I mean, it's a difficult challenge for all of us. You know, how do you be in a world without doing anything about it? You know, it means it's like a child. Why do we no matter what, no matter how angry we are or how disillusioned we are, just let a child walk in the room and everybody comes alive. What is that beauty? I mean, what have they done to get all of that beauty? You know, they are being who they are. We all have that. And I...
Yes, I'm sorry interrupting you, because you touched at that moment child came to the room, and that moment created by this child, and the whole universe was shifted just by this innocent, very transparent event.
Yes. And I think one of the tasks that we all have to do, you know, as adults, is to re-inhabit that innocence. And it's not like a child is very vulnerable in that innocence. It can be easily, it's not made conscious. It's just simply a state of being. I think as we grow older, we have to consciously inhabit that innocence. And that's a much more fierce involvement where it becomes our own. It's like a return. I think that's also one of the terrifying things of trusting in the universe, you might say, is that it really almost feels like we're going backwards, except it's a conscious turn back into conscious innocence. And it gets back to the awesomeness of that mountain that Annie Dillard talks about. You know, it's the very awe of that simplicity is just its being, and to be able to hold that innocent presence without imposing anything on it is the best of who we are.
I was particularly fascinated a number of years ago with one dimension, to be with a moment. To me, it was so ridiculous. After all, I have such a deficit of this and that, and I'm observing my colleagues and my very intellectually intense environment. How one can afford to be with the moment. And then when I got acquainted with the author and also thinker Eckhart Tolle, whose ideas, be perfectly honest with you, don't sit exactly with me in full force, but this idea being with the moment and not to resist what can be of unpleasant or negative impact on this moment. This dimension really made very profound impression on me. How do you feel for yourself the role of the moment? Are you catching yourself? Is it part of your life routine to be with the moment, whatever that moment can be?
Well, you know, a lot of our lives is involved with chopping wood and carrying water, you might say. And I think it's mostly about a kind of attention and watchfulness. You know, isn't there some biblical quote that says, watch, you know? So I think we do what we do. We enjoy our lives. We cook our meals. We do what we're doing in a daily life. And yet, when a moment comes in sideways and gets us out of our routine, if we're watchful, we can turn into that moment and do what is required. Like, for example, I might be working on an art piece and I'm just like totally focused doing in this direction, and someone might arrive at my door, and there may be a part of me that is annoyed with that. I don't want to deal with people right now. I'm doing my art. And yet, it might be God, you might say. And so I think it's about being with what is. And sometimes you might say this isn't a good time, you know, and that's okay sometimes. But, you know, I think it's about knowing you don't know anything. You know, your idea of what should be has nothing, may or may not have anything to do with reality. And so you're always stalking reality in each moment. And I can't say I sit here fully present in each moment, but I am watching. And there's very little that we miss with that kind of watchfulness, because we don't take anything we do or are seriously anymore, you know, because we always know that there's an inspired moment that could come through that completely blows it away. So how important is it if it's completely overrun? And if we're holding on to that which is disappearing, we go down with the ship. So there's nothing else to do but stalk the miracle in each moment.
Yes, I'm glad that I provoked you to express this philosophical dimension, which to me is absolutely highest quality for the artistic expression, freedom, and ultimate joy. I have to confess regrettably that we are coming to the end. I wanted deeply to thank my guest, whose generosity in every artistic human level was expressed in this very short hour, but so fully and so deeply. I wanted to ask you, Jerry, if you could tell to our listeners your website, after which I will conclude with my last thought about our program. So where can we find you?
Well, thank you, Lena, and I really appreciate the level of your attention in this interview. You are one of the better interviews I've ever done. I have to honestly say that. I mean, you have a fierce determination to hang in the depths, and I really, really do appreciate that. So thank you, first off. And my website is handsofalchemy.com, A-L-C-H-E-M-Y, Hands of Alchemy. Thank you very much.
It is my privilege, pleasure. Thank you for your kind words. And it is very moving for me to hear. Creates my own inspiration for many more moments with the artist and creator of our universe like yourself. I cannot find any better saying from Jerry Wenstrom's book as this one to conclude our program. Reason will take us to the door of heaven, but love will let us in. On this note, I will wish my guest continuation of his journey. Hopefully, we will have him back if he will have a moment for us. And I will say until next time.